the Institute on Religious Life and the Daughters of St. Mary of Providence of Chicago bring you the following lecture in a series given by Father John A. Hardin, S.J. on the theme, The History of Religious Life. Father John Hardin is a professor of theology at St. John's University in New York. He is a well-known lecturer and consultant to various national, religious, and educational enterprises, and is renowned as a retreat master and spiritual director. Father Hardin is the author of many articles and books, including Holiness in the Church and the Catholic Catechism, which has been strongly endorsed by Holy Mother Church. In the following lecture, Father Hardin speaks on the subject, St. Teresa of Avila and the Carmelite Reform. Father Hardin.
First, in terms of the title, notice we call this Teresian spirituality and not precisely Carmelite spirituality. There is more than passing importance in noting that what we call the great spiritualities of the Church, such as the Benedictine, the Franciscan, here, the Teresian, they are rather identifiable with some great man or woman who may indeed, and so far in all cases, happened also to be the founder or foundress of a religious community. But because the Church's authority stands behind the person, the word Franciscan spirituality is misleading. The word Dominican is misleading. There can be no misleading about Ignatian. Notice, because Ignatius is not the Jesuits. Well, St. Ignatius was, be it said, a Jesuit. The reason for the importance is, first of all, that the Church's authority stands behind the person whom she has either canonized or beatified, and above all, has approved that person's writing, soundness of doctrine, and for our purpose, way of sanctity. When the Church canonizes people, she infallibly declares two things. One, that the individual is certainly in heaven and the glory of God. But secondly, that this person's way of life is a secure and effective means of also attaining holiness. The spirituality, therefore, has to do with that tried and approved means of growing in holiness. It would be a mistake, frankly, to talk about Carmelite spirituality in a course like this. Now, there happens to be, we've finished as much as we really wanted to give attention to, Ignatian spirituality. But there is, and I think I mentioned, didn't I, the outstanding work on Jesuit spirituality by Father de Guibert. But when we talk about Teresian, we're talking about the spirituality of St. Teresa. We're talking about Dominican of St. Dominic, Franciscan, St. Francis. Am I clear? It is not the by now numerous and often quite different and, be it said, not always authentic. And I can say this from my own least Society of Jesus. You don't lose 10,000 men in 15 years in a religious order unless there's something wrong. And consequently, to make sure that when we talk about Teresa, we're talking about St. Teresa, Franciscan at St. Francis, and for the Franciscans in class, that is of great importance. Otherwise, we can get ourselves bogged down in all kinds of people's interpretation, which may be valid, may not be so valid, or at least are not, of that universal import which all the major spiritualities of the Church are. All right? Meant not just for Dominicans, the Dominican, or for Franciscans, the Franciscan, or the Theresians, for Carmelites, or of Ignatius, Ignatian, just for Jesuits. First, then, something about context. Regarding the origins of Carmel, as they speak of it, the Carmelites themselves, there are two descriptions of that origin. There is the traditional, which goes back to no less a person than the prophet Elijah. And for anyone who doubts it, all you have to go is St. Peter's in Rome, and among the, in the gallery of the founders, the great founders of religious institutes, is himself, Elijah. Well, I call that traditional. I didn't want to call the other historical. I changed my vocabulary. I call it documentary. Now, what do we know about the origins of the Carmelites back in Elijah's time? Now, clearly that's slightly before Christ, and there are other problems that arise if you take that literally. What it means is that in Palestine, Elijah himself was a great mystic and contemplative, that there seems to have been an unbroken chain of groups of contemplatives on or about Mount Carmel and Elijah, recognized as their great inspirer. The actual documentation about the foundation of the Carmelites has two types. And earlier in Palestine, with hermits following the rule of St. Augustine, and a group in Europe, both, by the way, in the 13th century, started by St. Simon Stock. From what country was St. Simon Stock? England. Approved, be it said, by the Second Ecumenical Council of Lyons. You will notice this is the third great religious tradition started in the 13th century. Carmelite origins, as far as they can be traced in a documentary way, with the Church's approval, date from the 13th century. You will notice the Palestinian origins are rather aromatical. Those in Europe are rather mendicant, more heavily on the apostolic and active in Europe, more contemplative and cloistered, even eremitical in Asia. Now, in drawing up your outline, I put abuses first and ambiguity second. It really should be ambiguity first and abuse a second. The first source of ambiguity, which then gave rise to a Teresa of Avila and a John of the Cross, we're talking now about three centuries of time, right? From their 13th century origins to the 16th century was long enough for the Carmelites to have fallen on bad times. There was need for reform, and hence the two great reformers, Teresa and John, came into existence. There was the ambiguity as to whether Carmelites should be hermits or should be living in a community. All I can tell you is the ambiguity is still there. What I mean is that there are those Carmelites who more strongly favor the eremitical and others the communal. Secondly, and corresponding to the first, whether the community should be strictly contemplative or whether it should engage in the act of apostolate outside the cloister. The Asian origins and those favoring the Oriental form would be more eremitical and more intensely cloistered and contemplative. Those in Europe, I'll leave it to Europeans to be the more activist. They would favor the more communal and externally apostolic. What then Teresa was doing is seeking to restore what she firmly believed was the primitive rule of Carmel, which was not European, but Oriental. The last four are abuses. The problem arose of whether the superiors in Carmelite foundations were to be well appointed or chosen for life. Not a few Carmelite institutes had superiors who stayed on a lifetime, which created not a few problems. Some were good superiors, some were not so good. That was an abuse. It was not so much in having permanent superiors as rather that the church had not sufficiently got control, or if the control was there externally, not a few Carmelites did not submit to the control of having, if you want permanent superiors, be sure they are qualified to rule for life. There are very few religious institutes in the Catholic Church today whose superiors are appointed or elected for life. The one dramatic exception is the Society of Jesus. Our general is elected for life. Fourth, but second abuse, private property. The Carmelites, though professing poverty, not a few of them, through obtaining permission, often coming from fairly wealthy families, though they might have protected themselves canonically by not using things, say, without permission, but not a few Carmelite institutions became weak in the practice of poverty, with scandal to the faithful, with often the more wealthy families migrating towards Carmel, with other disastrous results, notably the kind of vocations were not infrequently those who could afford it. Now those two fours are wrong. It should be five and six. I'm not sure what time of the night I did this. Outside work. That became quite an abuse. Although some of the greatest monastic leaders in Europe, take a man like St. Bernard, very active in working for the church. The point is, not everybody has the sanctity of a St. Bernard. In any case, the Carmelites were abusing the privilege which they had of being asked, invited, sometimes even commanded, by church authorities to engage in the act of apostolate. Let me tell you that one of the problems facing religious communities today, especially as they seek to be more contemplative, more prayerful, is to find ways, and if necessary, create means of saying no, even to sometimes worthy causes for the church. I think not a small part of the problem in the Catholic religious life today is that too many religious have too soon, in too great numbers, with too great intensity, became involved in all kinds of apostolic work, with a dreadful result that they were, well, zealous indeed, but they had in many cases even lost the right to the title religious, where religious has to do with the things of God. Finally, sounds like the 20th century, small convents, that became an abuse. They found that they could live more congenially in having a smaller group, no doubt, by choice. Now, if you could find all that many congenial people, well, have a large convent. But human nature being what it is, the odds are there wouldn't be all that many kindred spirits. That became an abuse. It created polarization. It deprived the religious of that kind of practice, especially of charity, which, having different kinds of people, the young and the old, the healthy and the sick, the ambitious and the not so ambitious, living together under the same roof, and in the practice of what by then must be Christ-like supernatural charity. So much for the abuses, towards which mainly when Teresa came to write and, of course, administer, she had to face. She had the option, of course, of either a larger foundation or a smaller one, but she decided that if you want to live the strictly contemplative life, larger numbers are a handicap. And this may have been the historical reason why so many of these convents that became, if not dissolute, at least not as fervent as they had been, because either, given the larger numbers, there were not a few who wanted to engage in the act of apostolate, which then weakened the spirit of the community, or if the numbers were small, they were gathered together as a small number not because the contemplative life could be better lived, but because it would be less demanding on human nature. And in fact, one reason, as you read Teresa's writings, one reason why the Carmelites, that is the authentic ones, practice very severe austerity is because they do not have, given the relatively small numbers, and they are carefully chosen, the kind of mortification that is built into any community that has a large variety of people. And since then, of course, the church has approved her way of life. So I would say, once she made the decision to be strictly contemplative, which was one of the decisions to make, she found from experience that having a larger number of women, now this, I have to say this, living as constantly in each other's company, notice, having no apostolic work outside of themselves to both absorb their attention and, well, divert their attention from one another. Does this make sense? people have written about, you know, why the number is small. I should add, however, that by then it had become quite common for small convents to exist. So she did not innovate the small size. She made sure, however, that the smallness of the size would not be because it would be easier, but rather would be more effective for the purpose for which the strictly cloistered contemplative life was founded. Among the significant features in her biography, just to mention one or the other, she had a series of bouts with illness. She was first, as you know, a boarder in an Augustinian convent, cloistered indeed, but Augustinian. She took sick, came back home, entered, well, a Carmelite convent, and then took sick again. It is well to note that between 1515, her birth, and 53, which she herself identifies as the date of her reconversion, that except for her having converted herself, she could never have reformed others. Now this I have noticed both in my dealing with people and by now the reading of the church's history. Sometimes we joke among ourselves as Jesuits. As we look back over the most demanding superiors that we have recollections of, the really tough hombres, not infrequently we found those who make the toughest superiors are those who in their own early days were not outstanding for austerity. There is such a thing as first learning the importance of being severe with oneself and to change one's life, as Teresa did, from being mediocre, and as we know, she was even told if she continued this way, she wouldn't be saved. In any case, her own conversion was a necessary factor in her becoming a reformer. Three names of three spiritual directors occur in her life, and leave it to me to put St. John of the Cross, I managed to find space for him in 1567. I should have put him, well, among the major events of her life, because there's nobody who is more major in Teresa's life than John of the Cross. But each contributed something to her sanctification and to her spirituality. Francis Borgia, the Jesuit general, himself, as we know, had been a married man. His wife died. He later on became a Jesuit and became one of our great generals. When she confessed, this is Teresa, to Francis, she by then already experienced mystical phenomena. He was the one who identified, and she was grateful for the rest of her days, he identified her gifts as being genuinely from God. Let me tell you, this is a great discovery. Because the more a person seeks to serve God intimately, and Teresa surely did, the more God will lead the soul by unique paths. There is no rule book by which you become a mystic. In any case, he identified her experiences as truly supernatural. Peter of Alcantara a contemporary, taught her the importance of penance. And St. John of the Cross gave her what without him she could never have done, gave her the contact with the Carmelite authorities and with the hierarchy in the church. Otherwise, she would have been Teresa, the would-be reformer, instead of the saint and the reformer that she actually was. Because behind what he pointed out to her was, if you want to reform the Carmelites, reform them from within. You cannot imagine how much this has meant to me, especially for the last 22 years in the Society of Jesus. I make no hesitation in publicly affirming the Society of Jesus needs a drastic reformation. I might also add, this is on a very personal note, but it needs saying, Ignatius, when he founded the Society of Jesus, because of his own great bent for the contemplative, cloistered life, into his constitutions gives his men the option, anytime they want to, we are free. A letter to the general is all that's required. I want to leave the Jesuits and become a Carthusian or a Trappist or a Camaldolese. And the general must respect my request. And no other permissions are necessary. And I try it out. If I find I can't take it, I must be readmitted. Isn't that good? That's Ignatius. What are the principal sources of her spirituality? Three writings: her autobiography, The Way of Perfection, and Carmelite theologians say, The Interior Castle, especially. Although I would distinguish, I would say if you look on Teresian spirituality in terms of method of how you get there, I think it's mainly her autobiography and Way of Perfection. If you want to know what Teresian spirituality is once you're there, then it's The Interior Castle. The roadmap is The Way of Perfection and the autobiography. The photograph of Teresa at her peak, when God's grace had, you might say, done its work in her soul, is The Interior Castle. Now the features. I don't know whether I've ever had occasion to mention this, but in the novitiate, our novice master, a very wise man, would not allow any of his novices to read either Teresa or John of the Cross. Did I tell you this? Now, we could get special permission, but he was a judge whether you could take it. I'm embarrassed to say I never asked permission, because what he told me about my state of soul convinced me he was sure I couldn't take it. Both Teresa and John, therefore, must be handled carefully. I have seen more good souls misguided, living a spirituality of illusion, from having too widely and indiscriminately steeped themselves in the literature of mysticism until they really thought they were mystics. Take it from a priest. It's what I call cerebral mysticism. It's all up here. Unmortified, proud, selfish. Better not to have read A Woman Like Teresa than to read and think, well, I'm not quite sure which castle I'm in, but I'm getting there. And not having coped with the fundamental drives of human nature, like pride, now the features. Some of these are obvious, some less so. None, however, is unimportant. I will try to say at least a sentence or two about each one. The primacy of prayer in the spiritual life means, as Teresa understands it, that you can quite identify one's spiritual life by the level of prayer that the person is living. Now that is profoundly true. All I know is that you require a professional guide to judge whether you are or are not progressing in the spiritual life, because maybe you don't see your prayer as advanced as St. Teresa might indicate. So one's spiritual life is mainly to be identified with one's union with God. Second, the primacy of grace in the growth in holiness. As we know, there are two elements necessary for becoming holy. They are divine grace and human freedom. Neither without the other makes a person holy. Now, Teresa lived, as we know, in that period of the Church's history when freedom was widely denied by the Reformers. What she brought out, and was very conscious of the need for exertion, using human effort, your own freedom. What she recognized, however, and no doubt God raised her for this purpose, is to lay to rest once and for all the charge that Catholicism so stresses good works that it ignores or even minimizes the prior necessity of grace. Consequently, while God wants everyone to be saved, and those who receive the gift of baptism, God also wants to become holy. But be it said, if some are holier than others, and the comparative degree is most true, it is not mainly because some are more generous. It is primarily because some have received the grace. And there is no greater pride, note to man, than the pride of thinking you've got the grace and you don't. Third, prayer is normative of spiritual progress. She uses these four figures of speech, which you may recall, that is, of progress in the sense of watering the soil, that prayer is the means of obtaining grace. Without grace, no holiness. How do you get the water, otherwise known as grace? Well, those four are just successively easier ways of getting grace. The most difficult is where you have to carry the water in a bucket. So you've got some kind of a mechanism that can, say, draw the water up. And then maybe even some vehicle that can transport the water. Irrigation, these are Teresa's figures of speech, simplifies it even more. And of course, the best is when you just sit inside and watch the rain come down. The language is very simple, but the lesson is profound. We must do what in us lies. But when God wants to give grace, that is the grace of prayer, which then makes for union with God, when it's Teresa's vocabulary is, union with God equals sanctity. And the subjective evidence of union with God is one's life of prayer. Where evidently, being a union, it is bifocal. The heart of union with God is God's giving himself through grace. But I'm not yet united unless I give myself with freedom. What Teresa is here illustrating is, how do you get the grace? Well, there are four successive ways. And provided you do your part, come a day. But as you know, it took years for her before the rain just came down. Rain symbolizing divine grace, the grace of prayer. And not to, say, either give up prayer or even weaken in one's life of prayer because it's hard. Don't be dumb, she would say. You're maybe just in the stage of carrying the water in buckets. So, you don't want your spiritual life to grow and the plants that God, well, has planted there to grow. It's too much work carrying the water. Don't be silly. Of course, it's hard work. Carry the water, lug the buckets. In time, if it is God's will, you won't have to carry any buckets. God will just come down. But, and this is one important qualification that has to be made regarding St. Teresa, and why it is of great importance not to just read Teresa or people like her and try to imitate her, because unless a person has the spirituality which this reflects, it is quite possible for a person to have difficulties with prayer, carrying the water in buckets, all one's life. Hardly knows how to spell the word mysticism and would surely be stumped on spelling the word ecstasy. Many people who wouldn't know how to spell the word ecstasy, let alone have one, can become great saints. You hear it? That's why we're going through the history of religious life. Notice, each saint has something to teach us. No one of them, no dozen of them, no thousand, exhaust the riches of the imitation of Christ. Martha was not Mary, right? Mary, no doubt, had ecstasies, and Martha, well, you know the story. Yet both are saints. How's that? Don't you think we need that? Otherwise, we're liable to read very fine, great spiritual literature of the ages, and then mistakenly suppose that because I have not even reached the second, let alone the third or fourth stage, how unholy I must be. Woe is me. 30 years in the religious life, and look at me. I haven't had even one 2-minute ecstasy.
Please turn over to side B and push the play button immediately without rewinding the tape.